Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Hope you're excited to be here, and I hope you're looking forward to staying for lunch. And so we will be out and ready to go to lunch about noon. We won't be out before that. Real quick, I was told this morning, if you're looking at shirt orders and those types of things, that we have samples of sweatshirts back there this morning, so you can look at sizes and stuff like that. Those hadn't previously been here, but they're here, so check those out and all that. And also, if you're downstairs helping with setting up for the Super Bowl, I'm not sure if the system is on this morning to pipe through the building or not, but if it is, thank you for being down there. Thank you for all the setup work that you're doing and all of that. If it's not set up to pipe through the building, then they didn't hear a word I said. So when we tell someone to stand up and be counted, we are telling them that it is okay to make your opinion, your beliefs known publicly, and even if it can cause you trouble, to stand up and be counted. For the early church leader Paul, much of his life was a stand up and be counted type of scenario. When he first entered the pages of history in the biblical narrative, he has stood up and been counted as one who is an opposer of the Jesus way. He's a Jewish religious leader who is out persecuting followers of Jesus and is committed to ending the Jesus movement altogether because it posed a threat to the Jewish belief system. It posed a threat to the Jewish way of life. And so he stood up and counted as someone who opposed it. After a personal encounter with the resurrected Jesus, he stood up and was counted as someone who would advance the Jesus way, who would travel the region and invite people to follow Jesus. Now, this was, though he and his traveling companions had great success, it was not met without intense opposition. There was a time where he was in a place called Antioch of Pisidia, and they uncovered a plot to do him harm and his traveling companions. And so he and his traveling companions fled from Antioch and Pisidia, went to a little town called Iconium. In Iconium, though he had great success there, some Jews from neighboring areas came and started stirring up problems for him. And their plot was to attack him and to stone him with the intent of killing him. He found about this plot and they ran him out of town. Actually, it's the opposite. The Antioch of Pisidia, they ran him out of town. In Iconium, they found out about the plot and fled. So it wasn't without opposition. And so when they leave Iconium, they go to this little region called Lyconia. And they wind up and they go to a Roman city by the name of Lystra. And when they get to Lystra, things tend to be looking pretty good and going pretty well for them. So we pick up Paul's traveling act in the book of Acts, which was written by the first century doctor and historian Luke, who set out to write an orderly account of Jesus' life, and then he traveled much of the time with Paul and chronicled what happened in the launch of the early church. So here's what it says in Acts 14. While they were at Lystra, Paul and Barnabas came upon a man with crippled feet. He had been that way from birth, so he had never walked. He was sitting and listening as Paul preached. Now, philosophers of the day would go into a city, and most of them, in communicating their message like Paul would do here, it's likely that he probably is on a street corner somewhere, and he's just preaching to the crowd that's gathered, and this guy is somewhere listening to Paul as he preaches. While Paul's usual practice was to go into a city and go to the Jewish synagogues to connect with the Jews and non-and Greek-speaking Jews there, there's no mention here that he goes into a synagogue. And it's likely because Lystra, being a Roman city, had so few Jews in it that it didn't even warrant having a synagogue there. So Paul is likely going in there and he's communicating about Jesus on a street corner, and this individual is listening. Now, a couple things that are interesting about this guy. It is next to impossible, other than from a figurative standpoint, for him to stand up and be counted. The man can't walk. He literally can't stand. And this isn't a temporary situation. This has been his entire life. He has never known what it is like to walk. As he has sat and watched, and it was common practice in the day that someone in his situation would sit at the city gate, and as people would come in, they would beg for money, and that's how they would make their money to be able to live and support themselves. And this is likely the situation with this man, that he has sat at the city gate. And so as people have come and gone, they know who this man is. They know that he's never walked. They know that he has crippled feet. But he has seen people walk. And he knows what it's like to want to walk. And he knows what it's like to see others experience the act of walking. But he himself had never walked. And then it says, looking straight at him. So there was something about this man that captured Paul's attention. And he captures Paul's attention. He says, looking straight at him, Paul realized he had the faith to be healed. Now, Luke doesn't tell us what Paul saw. It doesn't tell us that he noticed how intently the man was listening. It doesn't say that he noticed that as the man listened, he was staring at Paul. It doesn't say that the man said anything. It just says that Paul looked intently at him. And whatever he saw in this man, he said that he realized the man had the faith to be healed. Now, as I got to this part in the story, I had a question. And it's like, I wonder, when people look at us, when people see us, when people notice us as followers of Jesus, what do they see in us? Do they see in us someone who has faith that God can do far more than we can imagine? Do they see someone who's hesitant? Do they see someone who's bold? Do they see someone who's courageous? Do they see, what do people see in us as followers of Jesus? Do they see someone like this man who would have the faith to be healed? Now, as I came up with that question, I'm like, you know what? We're just going to have to leave that one there and let you wrestle with it on your own. To ask yourself the question, when people see me, when people notice me, what do they see in me? Do they see Jesus? I was at a funeral on, I don't even know what day it was. Huh? Thank you. See? She knows my schedule better than I do. I was at a funeral on Monday, and one of the speakers told this story at the beginning of his part of the funeral, and he said that the person who had passed, his name was Jinx. Actually, his name was Roscoe, but he went by Jinx. And somebody asked him one time, "Well, why do you go by Jinx?" He said, "If you knew my first name, you'd know why I go by Jinx." And he was a third, so he was Roscoe Williams Jenkins the third. So, but Jinx was what he was known by. Somebody said that Jinx used to claim that he knew everybody. And everybody claimed they knew Jinx. And so everywhere Jinx went, somebody knew Jinx. And he said one of his friends was traveling with him. And he said to him, he said, "You know, it seems like you know everybody." And Jinx said, "I do know everybody. I could run for the mayor of Greenwood and win." And he said, "Well, prove to me that you know somebody famous." So they took off and they went to L.A. and they knocked on this door. The person traveling with him didn't know. He knocked on the door and he said the guy who answered the door was Jimmy Stewart. And as soon as Jimmy Stewart opened the door, he reached out and he grabbed Jinx and he hugged him. He said, "Jinx, it's so good to see you. I haven't seen you in so long. It's so great." And the guy said, "Well, now you've proved to me that you know somebody famous." He said, "Prove to me that you know somebody important. Prove to me that you know the President of the United States." So they hopped on a plane and they flew from L.A. all the way to Washington, D.C. And as they approached the gates of the White House, the Secret Service came running out. And the guy expected them to stop them and keep them from going into the White House. But the Secret Service started yelling his name, "Jinx, Jinx, it's so good to see you. I'm so glad to see you. You haven't been here in so long. The President's going to be so glad that you're here." And the President, they told the President that he was here. And he's in the meeting with a bunch of United Nations leaders. And he tells them, he says, "I've got to cancel this meeting. You guys have to reschedule the conference because Jinx is here." And he goes in and he goes out and he grabs Jinx and he brings him into the White House and they have dinner at the White House. And his friend says, "Okay, now you've proved to me that you know somebody important." He said, "Now
Prove to me that you know somebody spiritual. Prove to me that you know the Pope. So, from Washington, D.C. to Vatican City they go, and they're in the middle of St. Peter's Square, and the Pope's scheduled to come out and speak. And all of a sudden, one of the Roman Vatican officials realizes that Jinx is there, and they go down and they grab Jinx and they usher him up to the Pope, and the Pope is so glad to see Jinx. And then the Pope comes out to speak at St. Peter's Square, and there standing next to him is Jinx. And the crowd's going crazy. They're chanting, Jinx, 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 Jinx. And then all of a sudden, down below, there's a commotion. And so Jinx leaves, and he goes down to find out what the commotion is. And there's a crowd of people gathered around his friend who's traveling with them. His friend's laying on the ground. He's passed out. They're able to revive him. And all the people are hugging Jinx as they come by, and Jinx barely makes it to his friends. And he says to him, what happened? Are you okay? And his friend looks at Jinx and says, I was hanging in there until somebody said, hey, who's the guy up there with Jinx? So the guy tells this story. And I'm sitting there and I'm waiting. And he ended the story there, by the way. And I'm sitting there and I'm waiting. And I'm like, and I think what he's going to do next is he's going to say, and then his friend looked at him. And he said, now, show me that you know Jesus. And his friend did, and Jinx did in every way. I expected the guy to go there. Because that's the type of thing that I wonder. When people see us, do they see us as someone more than knows who somebody famous? More than somebody who knows somebody important? More than somebody who knows somebody spiritual? But we know somebody who encapsulates all the above because we know Jesus. And when people see us, they see Jesus. So Paul called to him in a loud voice, stand up. And the man jumped to his feet and started walking. Now, I don't know how far in proximity they were to each other, but Paul called to him in a loud voice, and I'm sure that in the setting, when he called to him in a loud voice, he probably got the attention of everyone in the area, and everyone in the area turned and looked, and they saw Paul talking to the crippled man, the man they knew that had been crippled from birth, the man they knew that had never walked. And when they looked around, after Paul called out to him, realizing he was a man who had the faith to be healed, the man stood up. But notice that Luke doesn't say he stood up. He jumped up. The man jumped up. The man who had never walked jumped up. And for the first time in his life, he started walking. Imagine that moment. For the first time in his life, the man started walking. Well, when the crowd saw this, when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in their local dialect, these men are gods in human form. In the Greco-Roman belief system, it was not uncommon for them to believe that their individual gods could take on human form and come and enact punishment or reward to people. And so when they see what Paul had done, they immediately say that Paul and Barnabas and his traveling companions are gods. Because they were able to do this. It says they decided that Barnabas was the Greek god Zeus, who was the chief of the Greek gods. In the Roman culture, he was known as Jupiter. And they saw that Paul was Hermes, who would be one of Zeus's attendants, which was the god of eloquent speech. And in the Roman culture, he was known as Mercury, since he was the chief speaker. Now, part of the belief with this was there was a local legend in this part of the world at this time that Zeus and Hermes had come, taken on human form, and visited a couple by the name of Philemon and Baucis. And when they came and they visited them, Philemon and Baucis welcomed them and treated them well, and they were greatly rewarded. But there was a part of the population that rejected Greek or Zeus and Hermes, and they were met with great punishment. And so based on this legend, when the people of Lystra identify them as Zeus and Hermes, they are not going to make the same mistake of rejecting them. And it says Now, the temple of Zeus was located just outside the town. And so these regions believed that their town was protected by a specific god, and that Zeus was the chief of all the gods. And so they would build a temple just outside the city, or sometimes even in the city, where they would worship that god. It says, so the priest of the temple and the crowd brought bulls and wreaths of flowers to the town gates, and they prepared to offer sacrifices to the apostles. So they gather up the animals that they're going to use to sacrifice. This, again, was common practice in how they worshipped their gods. It says, but when the apostles Barnabas and Paul, which I think it's interesting there that now Luke flips the names again. Remember last week he flipped them from Barnabas and Saul to Paul and Barnabas, and now he flips them back. I would love to know why. So when I get to heaven, I'm going to seek out Luke, and I'm going to say, dude, why did you switch the names? I'm just going to know. So heard what was happening. They tore their clothing in dismay. So this act of tearing their clothing was a common practice of grief, of mourning, of even blasphemy. If someone was accusing blasphemy, the religious leaders would tear their clothes in grief and lament. And it says, and ran out among the people. Now, Greek gods and people claiming to be Greek gods would step back, and they would expect the people to come to them to bring them honor and to bring them glory. But instead of doing that, which would have been common to Zeus and Hermes, Paul and his traveling companions run out to the crowd and they shout to them, friends. And I love the fact that they call them friends. Friends, why are you doing this? In other words, why are you trying to sacrifice to us? Why are you bringing the bulls and the animals and the garland and all that? Why are you trying to do this? We are merely human beings, just like you. Though most people in the Greco-Roman belief system would have been willing to manipulate the belief system to take on the honor of a deity, especially those in political power, especially Roman emperors and Caesars and all that, they would welcome being included or equaled as a deity. But Paul and Barnabas and their traveling companions don't want any such honor for themselves. So they say, we are merely human beings like you. And then they say, we have come to bring you the good news that you should turn from worthless things and turn to the living God who made heaven and earth, the sea, and everything in them. So the worship in the Greco-Roman belief system would have been to idols, to man-made carved wooden stone-type statues that were made, that were symbolic and representative of those Greek gods. However, the Greeks and Romans also believed that there was the possibility of a supreme God. Paul doesn't leverage any type of Jewish scripture here like he does in other places, because there was no need. There was no Jewish context for the people that he's speaking to. So what he does is, instead of leveraging the Jewish scriptures, he leverages their belief in a supreme God and refers to him of the living God who made heaven and earth, the sea, and everything in them. So he connects them to their supreme being and identifies them as the God who has made everything, and refers to him as a living God. So he encourages them to give up the worthless things, the statues, the statues, the idols. And if you go with statue and idol together, it's called a statue, which is what I just did. So it's called a statue. So give up the statues, new word. It's going to make it into the dictionary next year. So in the past, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. But he never left them without evidence of himself and his goodness. To the Jewish people, God had given what was called a special revelation. He had given it through the promise to Abraham. He had given it through the law with Moses. He had given it through the prophets. He had given them special revelation about his relationship with them and their role in being a light to the nations, so that all nations could come to know God through the special relationship he had with Israel. to the other nations, he had not yet given them a special revelation other than the nation of Israel, who was to serve as a light to those nations. The only special revelation they had was the relationship between God and the nation of Israel. But Israel had all this other special revelation. What Paul says here is, though they may not have had a special revelation, God did not leave them without a general revelation of himself. That through nature and through his evidence and his goodness was displayed through nature, and they could see God every day, everywhere, through those types of things, because he is the living God who created it all. And though he had permitted nations to go their own way, they had been able to see evidence of him throughout. And then he gives them a specific instance that would have been very, very contextually understood with Lystra. Because their ancient writers indicate that rain was not, that there were times where Lystra didn't get a lot of rain. And so when they got rain, they were very, very joyous and very celebratory for the rain that they got, because it helped their crops. And he says, for instance, he sends you rain and good crops and gives you food and joyful hearts. So Paul says to the people at Lystra, you know how joyous you are when the rain comes, and then the rain produces the crops, and then you sit and you eat the food of the crops and you have joyful hearts because of all this? All of that is because God sends the rain. He said, now, we as people may be able to design intricate and amazing aqua systems. We may be able to develop irrigation systems that we can turn on in the summer and off in the winter. And we can have them winterized, and we can run water to our kitchen faucet, and we can run water to our yard. And thank goodness we can run water to our bathrooms. But not a single one of us can cause the rain. The only one who can cause the rain is the living God, that you may call the supreme being. But the living God who created the heaven and the earth and everything in it, he is the one who sends the rain. And you can look at the rain and you can see evidence of God. And you can gather the crops and you can see evidence of God. And you can eat the food and you can see evidence of God. And you can do it with a joyous heart, because he is the living God who has a deep, deep love and a deep, deep compassion for people just like you and just like me. But even with these words, Paul and Barnabas could scarcely restrain the people from sacrificing to them. Even when they pointed to God, even when they communicated about Jesus, which they had done over and over and over in their time there, the people were so focused on what they believed that they were going to sacrifice to him. Then things get really, really interesting. It says, then some Jews arrived from Antioch and Iconium. Now, even if you weren't with us, if you were paying attention about 10 minutes ago, how many people can tell us what happened in Antioch and Iconium? In Antioch, they were plotting to kill them. Paul and Barnabas and the traveling companions found out, so they fled from Antioch of Pisidia, which is different than Antioch of Syria, where they were headquartered, two different places. And Iconium, where a mob was incited against them and set out to attack and stone them. So some people from those areas showed up, and they won the crowds to their side. And I would be fascinated to know what took place to convince them. Have you ever noticed that a crowd can be very fickle? Have you ever noticed that people can shift their minds very quickly? And something happens here. These people come from out of town. Now, the government leaders had authority in their local thing to kick people out of the area, which is what was happening to Paul and Barnabas in different places. But they only had authority in their local area. So any leaders from Antioch and Iconium would have no authority in Lystra. But these aren't even city leaders. These aren't even government officials. These are Jewish people who came from Antioch and Iconium to cause problems for Paul and Barnabas. and their traveling companions. They make the trip there because what they tried to do in their own city, they couldn't get done. They wanted to get rid of Paul and Barnabas. They wanted to get rid of their traveling companions. They wanted to get rid of the Jesus movement altogether. So they were willing to travel from Antioch and Iconium to come to Lystra to cause problems. And they won the crowd over. And here's what happens next. They stoned Paul and dragged him out of the town, thinking he was dead. In one moment, Paul is thought to be a Greek god to be worshipped. And in the next moment, Paul is a criminal to be put to death. There was no trial. There were no witnesses. But there was a verdict reached nonetheless. The people had been stirred up, and they stoned Paul, and they dragged him out of the town. Now, typically, masonry-type rubble, rocks and tiles and ceramic and stone and all that, was very, very common laying out and about in the community, in the streets, in the first century. And so, if you were ticked off at somebody, it was easy to reach down and grab a rock and chuck it at them. So the resources to stone Paul were very readily available. But typically, stonings of this type, stonings of punishment, stonings of verdict, and all that took place outside the city gates. They would take the guilty person and they would take them out to the city gate or outside the city gate, and then they would stone them there. But notice what happens here. This stoning takes place inside the city gate. It's almost like it's impulsive. It's almost like it's driven by rage. It's almost like it's out of control. And so they stone Paul inside the city gates. Luke doesn't give us any indication that they stone Barnabas or they stone any of the other travelers or any of the other believers in Lystra. It seems from what Luke writes that their wrath, indignation is generated towards Paul specifically, and maybe only Paul. But they drag him out of the city. And when they drag him out of the city, I wonder if it's because in their minds they realize that these types of things occur outside the city and what we've just done is wrong. And if we can at least get him outside the city, we can take some of the pressure off of ourselves for what we've done, and maybe we can even convince ourselves that what we've done was okay. They drag him out of the city and they think he was dead. And that was their intent. Again, the individual who told them about Jesus, the individual who pointed them to the living God, the individual who you thought was a Greek God who said, "No, I'm not a Greek God." Then this outside group shows up, and whatever they say to him, all of a sudden they stone Paul, they drag him out of the city, and they think he was dead. It says, but as the believers gathered around him, and I assume at this point that this includes Paul's traveling companions and any of the other followers of Jesus who were in Lystra at the time. He says, but when they gathered around, and we don't know why they gathered around him. Maybe they gathered around him to keep the people who were attacking him at bay. Maybe they were gathering around him to prepare his body for burial. Maybe they were gathering around him to mourn the loss of someone they cared about and loved. We don't know why they gathered around, but what we do know is what happens when they gather around. It says, but as the believers gathered around him, he got up and went back to the town. Now, number one, it's amazing that he got up. You know, I mean, maybe he was just hit one time really good with one rock and he recovered after the effects wore off a little bit. But the indication here is that they thought he was dead. And so Peter, where did Peter come from? Peter came all the way from Jerusalem. Paul, it appears that Paul gets up when he shouldn't get up. And I like to think that in this moment, Paul stood up and was counted once again. That what they had tried to do in Antioch, they couldn't do. And what they had tried to do here in Iconium, they couldn't do. And what they tried to do in Lystra, they couldn't do. Not because of Paul, but because of the power of the living God. By the power of the living God that Paul said was the creator of the heavens and the earth and everything in it. The one who sends the rain, the one who gives the good crops, the one who gives us food, and the one in which we can have joyful heart. That Paul stood up and said, hey, by the way, what you tried to do, you couldn't do. Now, the other thing that I find amazing about this part of the story is that he went back into the town. I would not have gone back into the town. I would have gone to the next town. I would have gone to any other town. I would not have gone back into that town. But yet he went in to the town where people had just tried to kill him because he was willing to stand up and be counted even when it cost him something. The next day, he left with Barnabas for Derbe. Now, the next day, I have to think that if I had just been pummeled with rocks to the point of people thinking I was dead, but yet I had managed to get myself back up to my feet and into the town, I would have probably need a little bit of recovery time. I would need time to recover from the injuries. I would need time to recover from the humility. And I would probably need time to muster the courage to go back at it. I think this would have been one of the times where it would be easy to say, not doing it. God, I know you told me that you have chosen me to be the instrument to take the message to the Gentiles. I've done it, and it's been bad news everywhere I went. And now they've even tried to kill me. And not only have they plotted to kill me, thought to kill me, but this time they actually tried it. They threw rocks at me to the point and then dragged me out of the city when they thought I was dead. And I'm just not doing this anymore. Now would seem like a really, really good time to go back to being a full-time tent maker. Now might even be a really, really good time to rethink my belief system and go back to the Jewish religious leadership system where I was very comfortable and very famous and very popular and very influential and all of the above. But it says the next day, he left with Barnabas for Derbe. And guess what he does in Derbe? He starts telling people about Jesus. So, it says, finally, they returned by ship to Antioch of Syria, which is the church that had commissioned them to go and travel through the region, inviting people to follow Jesus, and it kind of become Paul and Barnabas' headquarters. So then they returned by ship to Antioch of Syria, where their journey had begun. The believers there had entrusted them, listen to this, they had entrusted them to the grace of God. It doesn't say that they entrusted the grace of God to them. They entrusted them to the grace of God. So as you go about these traveling acts, as you go from town to town, and as you encounter success, and as you encounter opposition and all of that, you are entrusted to the grace of God. So it's almost like the people in the church in Antioch were saying, may the grace of God protect you as you go. To do the work they had now completed, which was the missionary journey that they had just done. Go ahead. It says, upon arriving in Antioch, they called the church together and reported everything God had done through them. They didn't take credit for it. It was God that had done it. And how he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles too. And they stayed there with the believers for a long time. When we tell someone to stand up and be counted, we are telling them to make their opinion and their beliefs known publicly, even when it may cost them great opposition or great hardship. There is never a wrong time to stand up and be counted for what we believe. There is never a wrong time to stand up and be counted and point people to the living God. There is never a wrong time to stand up and be counted and invite people to follow Jesus. So, you may be able to knock on Jimmy Stewart's door and have him come and hug you and tell you how great it is to see you. You may be able to fly from L.A. to Washington, D.C. and get invited into dinner with the president who's canceled the United Nations conference because you showed up. You may be able to go to the Vatican City and have people pass out because they're amazed that the Pope comes out and stands with you. But when people see you, when you stand up and are counted, is what people see in you Jesus? Dear God, thank you for today. Thank you for this time. Thank you for this incredible story from Paul, from Paul's life that started in this little town called Lystra when they came across a man who had crippled feet. And the entire story flows from the fact that this man stood up and was counted as someone who was healed because Paul stood up and was counted as one who followed Jesus and wanted to invite people to follow as well. God, as we leave today, help each and every one of us wrestle with the question, when people see me, what do they see? Do they see Jesus? In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, thank you for being here. Thank you for choosing to spend this part of your Sunday with us. I hope that you'll spend a little more time with us, that you'll come downstairs and eat with us and just enjoy the time together. Have a great rest of the day and a great week.